Therefore, without shuddering or trembling, he heard the voice of his persecutor as he drew near. "Well, my boy," said Legree with a contemptuous kick, "how do you find yourself?"
"Didn't I tell you I could learn you a thing or two? How do you like it, eh? How did your wailing agree with you, eh, Tom? Ain't quite so crank as you was last night? You couldn't treat a poor sinner now to a bit of sermon, could you, eh?"
Tom answered nothing. "Get up, you beast," said Legree, kicking him again. This was a difficult matter for one so bruised and faint, and as Tom made efforts to do so, Legree laughed brutally.
"What makes ye so spry this morning, Tom? Cotched cold, maybe, last night?"
Tom by this time had gained his feet and was confronting his master with a steady, unmoved front.
"The devil you can," said Legree, looking him over. "I believe you haven't got enough yet. Now, Tom, get right down on your knees and beg my pardon for your shins last night."
Tom did not move.
"Down, you dog," said Legree, striking him with his riding whip.
"Master Legree," said Tom, "I can't do it. I did only what I thought was right. I shall do just so again. If ever the time comes, I never will do a cruel thing, come what may."
"Yes, but you don't know what may come, Master Tom. You think what you've got is something? I tell you, 'tain't anything, nothing at all. How would you like to be tied to a tree and have a slow fire lit up around you? Wouldn't that be pleasant, huh, Tom?"
"Master," said Tom, "I know you can do dreadful things, but..." He stretched himself upward and clasped his hands. "But after you've killed the body, there ain't no more ye can do. And oh, there's all eternity to come after that."
Eternity. The word thrilled through the black man's soul with light and power as he spoke. It thrilled through the sinner's soul, too, like the bite of a scorpion. Legree gnashed on him with his teeth, but rage kept him silent. And Tom, like a man disenthralled, spoke in a clear and cheerful voice.
"Master Legree, as ye bought me, I'll be a true and faithful servant to ye. I'll give ye all the work of my hands, all my time, all my strength, but my soul I won't give up to mortal man. I will hold on to the Lord and put his commands before all, die or live, you may be sure on it. Master Legree, I ain't a grain of fear to die. I'd as soon die as not. Ye may whip me, starve me, burn me. It'll only send me sooner where I want to go."
"I'll make you give out, though, for you've done," said Legree in rage.
"I shall have help," said Tom.
"You'll never do it." "Who the devil's going to help you?" said Legree scornfully.
"The Lord Almighty," said Tom.
"Darn ye!" said Legree, as with one blow of his fist he felled Tom to the earth.
A cold, soft hand fell on Legree's. At this moment, he turned. It was Cassie's, but the cold, soft touch recalled his dream of the night before, and flashing through the chambers of his brain came all the fearful images of the night watches, with a portion of the horror that accompanied them. "Will you be a fool," said Cassie, in French. "Let him go. Let him alone, to get him fit to be in the field again. Isn't it just as I told you?"
They say the alligator, the rhinoceros, though enclosed in bullet-proof mail, have each a spot where they are vulnerable, and fierce, reckless, unbelieving reprobates have commonly this point in superstitious dread.
Legree turned away, determined to let the point go for the time.
"Well, have it your own way," he said doggedly to Cassie.
"Hark ye," he said to Tom, "I won't deal with you now, because the business is pressing, and I want all my hands. But I never forget. I'll score it against ye, and sometimes I'll have my payout. Oh, your old black hide, mind ye."
Legree turned and went out.
"There you go," said Cassie, looking darkly after him. "Your reckoning's to come yet. My poor fellow, how are you?"
"The Lord God hath sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth for this time," said Tom.
"For this time, to be sure," said Cassie. "But now you've got his ill will upon you, to follow you day in, day out, hanging like a dog on your throat, sucking your blood, bleeding away your life, drop by drop.
I know the man."
Chapter 37 Liberty.
No matter with what solemnities he may have been devoted upon the altar of slavery, the moment he touches the sacred soil of Britain, the altar and the god sink together in the dust, and he stands redeemed, regenerated, and disenthralled by the irresistible genius of universal emancipation. Curran. A while we must leave Tom in the hands of his persecutors, while we turn to pursue the fortunes of George and his wife, whom we left in friendly hands, in a farmhouse on the roadside. Tom Loker we left groaning and towsling in a most immaculately clean Quaker bed, under the motherly supervision of Aunt Dorcas, who found him to the full as tractable a patient as a sick bison. Imagine a tall, dignified spiritual woman, whose clear muslin cap shades waves of silvery hair parted on a broad, clear forehead, which overarches thoughtful grey eyes. A snowy handkerchief of lisse crepe is folded neatly across her bosom. Her glossy brown silk dress rustles peacefully as she glides up and down the chamber. "The devil," says Tom Loker, giving a great throw to the bedclothes. "I must request thee, Thomas, not to use such language," says Aunt Dorcas, as she quietly rearranged the bed. "Well, I won't, Granny, if I can help it," says Tom. "But it is enough to make a fellow swear, so cursedly hot." Dorcas removed a comforter from the bed, straightened the clothes again, and tucked them in till Tom looked something like a chrysalis, remarking as she did so, "I wish, friend, thee would leave off cursing and swearing, and think upon thy ways." "What the devil," said Tom, "should I think of them for? Last thing I ever want to think of, hang it all." And Tom flounced over, untucking and disarranging everything, in a manner frightful to behold. "That fellow and gal are here, I suppose," said he, sullenly, after a pause. "They are so," said Dorcas. "They'd better be off up to the lake," said Tom, "the quicker the better." "Probably they will do so," said Aunt Dorcas, knitting peacefully. "And hark ye," said Tom, "we've got correspondents in Sandusky that watch the boats for us. I don't care if I tell. Now I hope they will get away, just to spite Marks, that cursed puppy. Darn him!" "Thomas," said Dorcas. "I tell you, Granny, if you bottle a fellow up too tight, I shall split," said Tom. "But about that gal, tell him to dress her up some way, so's to alter her. Her description's out in Sandusky." "We will attend to that matter," said Dorcas with characteristic composure. As we at this place take leave of Tom Loker, we may as well say that having lain 3 weeks at the Quaker dwelling, sick with a rheumatic fever, which set in company with his other afflictions, Tom arose from his bed a somewhat sadder and wiser man, and, in place of slave-catching, betook himself to life in one of the new settlements, where his talents developed themselves more happily in trapping bears, wolves, and other inhabitants of the forest, in which he made himself quite a name in the land. Tom always spoke reverently of the Quakers. "Nice people," he would say, "wanted to convert me, but couldn't come it, exactly. But tell you what, stranger, they do fix up a sick fellow first rate, no mistake. Make just the tallest kind of broth and knick-knacks." As Tom had informed them that their party would be looked for in Sandusky, it was thought prudent to divide them. Jim, with his old mother, was forwarded separately, and a night or two after, George and Eliza, with their child, were driven privately into Sandusky, and lodged beneath a hospital roof, preparatory to taking their last passage on the lake. Their night was now far spent, and the morning star of liberty rose fair before them. Electric world! What is it? Is there anything more in it than a name, a rhetorical flourish? Why, men and women of America, does your heart's blood thrill at that word, for which your fathers bled, and your braver mothers were willing that their noblest and best should die? Is there anything in it glorious and dear for a nation, that is not also glorious and dear for a man? What is freedom to a nation, but freedom to the individuals in it? What is freedom to that young man, who sits there with his arms folded over his broad chest, the tint of African blood in his cheek, its dark fires in his eyes? What is freedom to George Harris? To your fathers, freedom was the right of a nation to be a nation. To him it is the right of a man to be a man, and not a brute, the right to call the wife of his bosom his wife, and to protect her from lawless violence, the right to protect and educate his child, the right to have a home of his own, a religion of his own, a character of his own, unsubject to the will of another. All these thoughts were rolling and seething in George's breast, as he was pensively leaning his head on his hat, watching his wife as she was adapting to her slender and pretty form the articles of man's attire, in which it was deemed safest she should make her escape. "Now for it," said she, as she stood before the glass, and shook down her silky abundance of black curly hair. "I say, George, it's almost a pity, isn't it?" she said, as she held up some of it playfully. "Pity, it's all got to come off." George smiled sadly, and made no answer. Eliza turned to the glass, and the scissors glittered as one long lock after another was detached from her head. "There now, that'll do," she said, taking up a hairbrush. "Now for a few fancy touches. There, "Ain't I a pretty young fellow?" she said, turning around to her husband, laughing and blushing at the same time. "You always will be pretty. Do what you will," said George. "What does make you so sober?" said Eliza, kneeling on one knee and laying her hand on his. "We are only within 24 hours of Canada, they say. Only a day and a night on the lake, and then, oh, then." "Oh, Eliza," said George, drawing her towards him, "that is it. Now my fate is all narrowing down to a point. To come so near, to be almost in sight, and then lose all? I should never live under it, Eliza." "Don't fear," said his wife hopefully. "The good Lord would not have brought us so far if he didn't mean to carry us through. I seem to feel him with us, George." "You are a blessed woman, Eliza," said George, clasping her with a convulsive grasp. "But, oh, tell me, can this great mercy be for us? Will these years and years of misery come to an end? Shall we be free?" "I'm sure of it, George," said Eliza, looking upward while tears of hope and enthusiasm shone on her long, dark lashes. "I feel it in me, that God is going to bring us out of bondage this very day." "I will believe you, Eliza," said George, rising suddenly up. "I will believe. Come, let's be off." "Well, indeed," said he, holding her off at arm's length and looking admiringly at her. "You are a pretty little fellow. That crop of little short curls is quite becoming. Put on your cap, so a little to one side. I never saw you look quite so pretty. But it's almost time for the carriage. I wonder if Mrs. Smith has got Harry rigged." The door opened, and a respectable middle-aged woman entered, leading little Harry dressed in girl's clothes. "What a pretty girl he makes," said Eliza, turning him round. "We call him Harriet, you see. Don't the name come nicely?"
The child stood gravely regarding his mother in her new and strange attire, observing a profound silence and occasionally drawing deep sighs, and peeping at her from under his dark curls.
"Does Harry know Mama?" said Eliza, stretching her hands toward him.
The child clung shyly to the woman.
"Come, Eliza, why do you try to coax him when you know that he has got to be kept away from you?"
"I know it's foolish," said Eliza, "yet I can't bear to have him turn away from me. But come, where's my cloak?"
"Here. How is it men put on cloaks, George?"
"You must wear it so," said her husband, throwing it over his shoulder.
"So then," said Eliza, imitating the motion, "and I must stamp and take long steps and try to look saucy."
"Don't exert yourself," said George. "There is now and then a modest young man, and I think it would be easier for you to act that character."
"And these gloves, mercy upon us," said Eliza. "Why, my hands are lost in them."
"I advise you to keep them on pretty strictly," said George. "Your slender paw might bring us all out. Now, Mrs. Smith, you are to go under our charge and to be our auntie. You mind?"
"I've heard," said Mrs. Smith, "that there have been men down, warning all the packet captains against a man and woman with a little boy."
"They have?" said George. "Well, if we see any such people, we can tell them."
A hack now drove to the door, and the friendly family who had received the fugitives crowded around them with farewell greetings.
The disguises the party had assumed were in accordance with the hints of Tom Loker. Mrs. Smith, a respectable woman from the settlement in Canada, whither they were fleeing, being fortunately about crossing the lake to return thither, had consented to appear as the aunt of little Harry, and in order to attach him to her, he had been allowed to remain the 2 last days under her sole charge, and an extra amount of petting, jointed to an indefinite amount of seed cakes and candy, had cemented a very close attachment on the part of the young gentleman.
The hack drove to the wharf. The 2 young men, as they appeared, walked up the plank into the boat, Eliza gallantly giving her arm to Mrs. Smith, and George attending to their baggage. George was standing at the captain's office settling for his party, when he overheard 2 men talking by his side.
"I've watched every one that came on board," said one, "and I know they're not on this boat."
The voice was that of the clerk of the boat. The speaker whom he addressed was our sometime friend, Marks, who with that valuable perseverance which characterized him had come on to Sandusky, seeking whom he might devour.
"You would scarcely know the woman from a white one," said Marks. "The man is a very light mulatto. He has a brand in one of his hands."
The hand with which George was taking the tickets and change trembled a little, but he turned coolly around, fixed an unconcerned glance on the face of the speaker, and walked leisurely toward another part of the boat, where Eliza stood waiting for him. Mrs. Smith, with little Harry, sought the seclusion of the ladies' cabin, where the dark beauty of the supposed little girl drew many flattering comments from the passengers. George had the satisfaction, as the bell rang out its farewell peal, to see Marks walk down the plank to the shore, and drew a long sigh of relief, when the boat had put a returnless distance between them. It was a superb day. The blue waves of Lake Erie danced, rippling and sparkling in the sunlight. A fresh breeze blew from the shore, and the lordly boat ploughed her way right gallantly onward.
Oh, what an untold world there is in one human heart! Who thought, as George walked calmly up and down the deck of the steamer, with his shy companion at his side, of all that was burning in his bosom?
The mighty good that seemed approaching seemed too good, too fair, even to be a reality, and he felt a jealous dread every moment of the day that something would rise to snatch it from him. But the boat swept on, hours fleeted, and at last clear and full rose the blessed English shores, shores charmed by a mighty spell, with one touch to dissolve every incantation of slavery, no matter in what language pronounced, or by what national power confirmed. George and his wife stood arm in arm as the boat neared the small town of Amherstburg in Canada. His breath grew thick and short, a mist gathered before his eyes. He silently pressed the little hand that lay trembling on his arm. The bell rang. The boat stopped. Scarcely seeing what he did, he looked out his baggage and gathered his little party. The little company were landed on the shore. They stood still till the boat had cleared, and then with tears and embracings, the husband and wife with their wondering child in their arms, knelt down and lifted up their hearts to God, to something like the burst from death to life, from the grave cements to the robes of heaven, from sin's dominion and from passion's strife, to the pure freedom of a soul forgiven, where all the bonds of death and hell are riven. And mortal puts on immortality, when mercy's hand hath turned the golden key, and mercy's voice hath said, "Rejoice, thy soul is free." The little party were soon guided by Mrs. Smith to the hospitable abode of a good missionary, whom Christian charity has placed here as a shepherd to the outcast and wandering, who are constantly finding an asylum on this shore. Who can speak the blessedness of that first day of freedom? Is not the sense of liberty a higher and a finer one than any of the five? To move, speak, and breathe, go out and come in unwatched, and free from danger. Who can speak the blessings of that rest, which comes down on the free man's pillow, under laws which ensure to him the rights that God has given to man? How fair and precious to that mother was that sleeping child's face, endeared by the memory of a thousand dangers. How impossible was it to sleep, in the exuberant possession of such blessedness, and yet these two had not one acre of ground, not a roof that they could call their own. They had spent their all to the last dollar. They had nothing more than the birds of the air or the flowers of the field. Yet they could not sleep for joy. O ye who take freedom from man, with what word shall ye answer it to God? Chapter 38. The Victory. Thanks be unto God, who giveth us the victory. 1 Corinthians 15:57. Have not many of us in the weary way of life felt in some hours how far easier it were to die than to live? The martyr, when faced even by a death of bodily anguish and horror, finds in the very terror of his doom a strong stimulant and tonic. There is a vivid excitement, a thrill and fervor, which may carry through any crisis of suffering that is the birth hour of eternal glory and rest. But to live, to wear on, day after day of mean, bitter, low, harassing servitude, every nerve dampened and depressed, every power of feeling gradually smothered, this long and wasting heart martyrdom, this slow daily bleeding away of the inward life, drop by drop, hour after hour, this is the true searching test of what there may be in man or woman. When Tom stood face to face with his persecutor, and heard his threats, and thought in his very soul that his hour was come, his heart swelled bravely in him, and he thought he could bear torture and fire, bear anything, with the vision of Jesus in heaven, but just a step beyond. But when he was gone, and the present excitement passed off, came back the pain of his bruised and weary limbs, came back the sense of his utterly degraded, hopeless, forlorn estate, and the day passed wearily enough. Long before his wounds were healed, Legree insisted that he should be put to the regular field work. And then came day after day of pain and weariness, aggravated by every kind of injustice and indignity that the ill will of a man and malicious mind could devise. Whoever in our circumstances has made trial of pain, even with all the alleviations which for us usually attend it, must know the irritation that comes with it. Tom no longer wondered at the habitual surliness of his associates. Nay, he found the placid, sunny temper, which had been the habitude of his life, broken in on, and sorely strained, by the inroads of the same thing. He had flattened himself on leisure to read his Bible, but there was no such thing as leisure there. In the height of the season, Legree did not hesitate to press all his hands through Sundays and weekdays alike. Why shouldn't he? He made more cotton by it, and gained his wager, and if it wore out a few more hands, he could buy better ones. At first Tom used to read a verse or two of his Bible by the flicker of the fire, after he had returned from his daily toil. But after the cruel treatment he received, He used to come home so exhausted that his head swam and his eyes failed when he tried to read, and he was fain to stretch himself down with the others in utter exhaustion. Is it strange that the religious peace and trust which had upborne him hitherto should give way to tossings of soul and despondent darkness? The gloomiest problem of this mysterious life was constantly before his eyes. Souls crushed and ruined, evil triumphant, and God silent. It was weeks and months that Tom wrestled, in his own soul, in darkness and sorrow. He thought of Miss Ophelia's letter to his Kentucky friends, and would pray earnestly that God would send him deliverance. And then he would watch day after day, in the vague hope of seeing somebody sent to redeem him. And when nobody came, he would crush back to his soul bitter thoughts, that it was vain to serve God, that God had forgotten him. He sometimes saw Cassie, and sometimes, when summoned to the house, caught a glimpse of the dejected form of Emmeline, but held very little communion with either. In fact, there was no time for him to commune with anybody. One evening he was sitting in utter dejection and prostration by a few decaying brands, where his coarse supper was baking. He put a few bits of brushwood on the fire, and strove to raise the light, and then drew his worn Bible from his pocket. There were all the marked passages which had thrilled his soul so often, words of patriarchs and seers, poets and sages, who from early time had spoken courage to man, voices from the great cloud of witnesses who ever surround us in the race of life. Had the word lost its power? Or could the failing eye and weary sense no longer answer to the touch of that mighty inspiration? Heavily sighing, he put it in his pocket. A coarse laugh roused him. He looked up. Legree was standing opposite to him. "Well, old boy," he said, "you find your religion don't work, it seems. I thought I should get that through your wall at last." The cruel taunt was more than hunger and cold and nakedness. Tom was silent. "You were a fool," said Legree, "for I meant to do well by you when I bought you. You might have been better off than Sambo or Quimbo either, and had easy times, and instead of getting cut up and thrashed every day or two, you might have had liberty to lord it round and cut up the other niggers, and you might have had now and then a good warming of whiskey punch. Come, Tom, don't you think you'd better be reasonable? Heave that our old pack of trash in the fire and join my church." "The Lord forbid," said Tom fervently. "You see, the Lord ain't gonna help you. If he had been, he wouldn't have let me get you. This year religion is all a mess of lying trumpery, Tom. I know all about it. You'd better hold to me. I'm somebody, and you can do something." "No, massa," said Tom. "I'll hold on. The Lord may help me, or not help, but I'll hold on to him, and believe him to the last." "The more fool you," said Legree, spitting scornfully at him and spurning him with his foot. "Never mind. I'll chase you down yet and bring you under. You'll see." And Legree turned away. When a heavy weight presses the soul to the lowest level at which endurance is possible, there is an instant and desperate effort of every physical and moral nerve to throw off the weight, and hence the heaviest anguish often precedes a return tide of joy and courage. So was it now with Tom. The atheistic taunts of his cruel master sunk his before dejected soul to the lowest ebb, and though the hand of faith still held to the eternal rock, it was a numb, despairing grasp. Tom sat, like one stunned, at the fire. Suddenly everything round him seemed to fade, and a vision rose before him of one crowned with thorns, buffeted and bleeding. Tom gazed in awe and wonder at the majestic patience of the face. The deep, pathetic eyes thrilled him to his inmost heart. His soul woke, as with floods of emotion. He stretched out his hands and fell upon his knees. When gradually the vision changed, the sharp thorns became rays of glory, and in splendor inconceivable he saw that same face bending compassionately towards him, and a voice said, "He that overcometh shall sit down with me on my throne, even as I also overcometh, and am set down with my Father on his throne." How long Tom lay there he knew not. When he came to himself the fire was gone out. His clothes were wet with the chill and drenching dews. But the dread soul crisis was past, and in the joy that filled him, he no longer felt hunger, cold, degradation, disappointment, wretchedness. From his deepest soul, he that hour loosed and parted from every hope in life that now is and offered his own will, an unquestioning sacrifice to the infinite. Tom looked up to the silent, ever-living stars, types of the angelic hosts who ever looked down on man, and the solitude of the night rung with the triumphant words of a hymn, which he had sung often in happier days, but never with such feeling as now.
The earth shall be dissolved like snow. The sun shall cease to shine. But God, who called me here below, shall be forever mine. And when this mortal life shall fail, and flesh and sense shall cease, I shall possess within the veil a life of joy and peace. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining like the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun.
Those who have been familiar with the religious histories of the slave population know that relations like what we have narrated are very common among them. We have heard some, from their own lips, of a very touching and affecting character. The psychologist tells us of a state in which the affections and images of the mind become so dominant and overpowering that they press into their service the outward imaging. Who shall measure what an all-pervading spirit may do with these capabilities of our mortality, or the ways in which he may encourage the desponding souls of the desolate? If the poor forgotten slave believes that Jesus hath appeared and spoken to him, who shall contradict him? Did he not say that his mission in all ages was to bind up the broken-hearted and set at liberty them that are bruised? When the dim grey of dawn woke the slumberers to go forth to the field, there was among those tattered and shivering wretches one who walked with an exultant tread, for firmer than the ground he trod on was his strong faith in almighty, eternal love. Ah, Legree, try all your forces now. Utmost agony, woe, degradation, want, and loss of all things shall only hasten on the process by which he shall be made a king and a priest unto God. From this time an inviolable sphere of peace encompassed the lowly heart of the oppressed one. An ever-present Saviour hallowed it as a temple. Past now the bleeding of earthly regrets, past its fluctuations of hope and fear and desire, the human will bent and bleeding and struggling long was now entirely merged in the divine. So short now seemed the remaining voyage of life, so near, so vivid seemed eternal blessedness, that life's uttermost woes fell from him unharming. All noticed the change in his appearance. Cheerfulness and alertness seemed to return to him, and a quietness which no insult or injury could ruffle seemed to possess him. "What the devil's got into Tom?" Legree said to Sambo. "A while ago he was all down in the mouth, and now he's pert as a cricket." "Dunno, Massa Gwinner. Run off, mibby?"
"Like to see him try that," said Legree with a savage grin.
"Wouldn't we, Sambo?"
"Guess we would, ha ha,"
said the sooty gnome, laughing obsequiously. "Lord, a fun to see him stricken in the mud, chasing and tearing through the bushes. Dogs are holding on to him. Lord, I laugh fit and split that our time we caught Molly. I thought they had her all stripped up before I get him off. She carries the marks of that our spree yet."
"I reckon she will, to her grave," said Legree. "But now, Sambo, you look sharp. If the nigger's got anything of this sort going, trip him up."
"Massa, let me alone for that," said Sambo. "I'll treat a coon, ha ha ha."
This was spoken as Legree was getting on his horse to go to the neighboring town. That night, as he was returning, he thought he would turn his horse and ride round the quarters and see if all was safe. It was a superb moonlight night, and the shadows of the graceful china trees lay minutely penciled on the turf below, and there was that transparent stillness in the air which it seems almost unholy to disturb. Legree was a little distance from the quarters when he heard the voice of someone singing. It was not a usual sound there, and he paused to listen. A musical tenor voice sang,
"When I can read my title clear to mansions in the skies, I'll bid farewell to every fear and wipe my weeping eyes. Should earth against my soul engage and hellish darts be hurled, then I can smile at Satan's rage and face a frowning world. Let cares like a wild deluge come, and storms of sorrow fall. May I but safely reach my home, my God, my heaven, my all."
"So-ho," said Legree to himself. "He thinks so, does he?
How I hate these cursed Methodist hymns. Here, you nigger," said he, coming suddenly out upon Tom, and raised his riding whip.
How dare you be getting up this year, Ro, when you ought to be in bed? Shut your old black gash and get along in with you.
Yes, massa, said Tom with ready cheerfulness as he rose to go in.
Legree was provoked beyond measure by Tom's evident happiness, and riding up to him belabored him over his head and shoulders. There, you dog, he said. See if you'll feel so comfortable after that.
But the blows fell now only on the outer man, and not as before on the heart.
Tom stood perfectly submissive, and yet Legree could not hide from himself that his power over his bond thrall was somehow gone. And as Tom disappeared in his cabin and he wheeled his horse suddenly round, there passed through his mind one of those vivid flashes that often send the lightning of conscience across the dark and wicked soul. He understood full well that it was God who was standing between him and his victim, and he blasphemed him. That submissive and silent man whom taunts, nor threats, nor stripes, nor cruelties could disturb, roused a voice within him, such as of old his master roused in the demoniac soul, saying, What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to torment us before the time? Tom's whole soul overflowed with compassion and sympathy for the poor wretches by whom he was surrounded. To him it seemed as if his life sorrows were now over, and as if out of that strange treasury of peace and joy with which he had been endowed from above, he longed to pour out something for the relief of their woes. It is true, opportunities were scanty, but on the way to the fields and back again, and during the hours of labor, chances fell in his way of extending a helping hand to the weary, the disheartened, and the discouraged. The poor, worn-down, brutalized creatures, at first, could scarce comprehend this. But when it was continued week after week and month after month, it began to awaken long, silent chords in their benumbed hearts. Gradually and imperceptibly the strange, silent, patient man, who was ready to bear everyone's burden, and sought help from none, who stood aside for all and came last and took least, yet was foremost to share his little all with any who needed. The man who in cold nights would give up his tattered blanket to add to the comfort of some woman who shivered with sickness, and who filled the baskets of the weaker ones in the field, at the terrible risk of coming short in his own measure, and who, though pursued with unrelenting cruelty by their common tyrant, never joined in uttering a word of reviling or cursing. This man, at last, began to have a strange power over them. And when the more pressing season was past, and they were allowed again, their Sundays, for their own use, many would gather together to hear from him of Jesus. They would gladly have met to hear and pray and sing in some place together, but Legree would not permit it, and more than once broke up such attempts with oaths and brutal execrations, so that the blessed news had to circulate from individual to individual. Yet who can speak the simple joy with which some of those poor outcasts to whom life was a joyless journey to a dark unknown heard of a compassionate Redeemer and a heavenly home? It is the statement of missionaries, that of all races of the earth, none have received the gospel with such eager docility as the African. The principle of reliance and unquestioning faith, which is its foundation, is more a native element in this race than any other. And it has often been found among them that a stray seed of truth, born on some breeze of accident into hearts the most ignorant, has sprung up into fruit, whose abundance has shamed that of higher and more skillful culture. The poor mulatto woman, whose simple faith had been well nigh crushed and overwhelmed by the avalanche of cruelty and wrong which had fallen upon her, felt her soul raised up by the hymns and passages of Holy Writ, which this lowly missionary breathed into her ear in intervals, as they were going to and returning from work. And even the half-crazed and wandering mind of Cassie was soothed and calmed by his simple and unobtrusive influences. Stung to madness and despair by the crushing agonies of life, Cassie had often resolved in her soul an hour of retribution, when her hand should avenge on her oppressor all the injustice and cruelty to which she had been witness, or which she had in her own person suffered. One night, after all in Tom's cabin were sunk in sleep, he was suddenly aroused by seeing her face at the hole between the logs that served for a window. She made a silent gesture for him to come out. Tom came out the door. It was between 1 and 2 o'clock at night, broad, calm, still moonlight. Tom remarked, as the light of the moon fell upon Cassie's large black eyes, that there was a wild and peculiar glare in them, unlike their wonted fixed despair. "Come here, Father Tom," she said, laying her small hand on his wrist, and drawing him forward with a force, as if the hand were of steel. "Come here. I've news for you." "What?" "Miss Cassie," said Tom anxiously. "Tom, wouldn't you like your liberty?" "I shall have it, missus, in God's time," said Tom. "Ay, but you may have it tonight," said Cassie, with a flash of sudden energy. "Come on." Tom hesitated. "Come," said she in a whisper, fixing her black eyes on him. "Come along. He's asleep sound. I put enough into his brandy to keep him so. I wish I'd had more. I shouldn't have wanted you. But come. The back door is unlocked. There's an axe there. I put it there. His room door is open.
I'll show you the way. I'd have done it myself, only my arms are so weak. Come along.
Not for 10,000 worlds, missy, said Tom, firmly stopping and holding her back as she was pressing forward.
But think of all these poor creatures, said Cassie. We might set them all free and go somewhere in the swamps and find an island and live by ourselves. I've heard of its being done. Any life is better than this.
No, said Tom firmly. No, good never comes of wickedness. I'd sooner chop my right hand off.
Then I shall do it, said Cassie, turning. Oh, Missy Cassie, said Tom, throwing himself before her, for the dear Lord's sake, that died for you, don't sell your precious soul to the devil that way. Nothing but evil will come of it. The Lord hasn't called us to wrath. We must suffer and wait his time.
Wait, said Cassie. Haven't I waited? Waited till my head is dizzy and my heart sick. What has he made me suffer? What has he made hundreds of poor creatures suffer? Isn't he wringing the lifeblood out of you? I'm called on. They call me. His time has come. I'll have his heart's blood.
No, 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 said Tom, holding her small hands, which were clenched with spasmodic violence.
No, ye poor la soul, that ye mustn't do. The dear blessed Lord never shed no blood but his own, and that he poured out for us when we was enemies. Lord, help us to follow his steps and love our enemies.
Love, said Cassie, with a fierce glare. Love such enemies. It isn't in flesh and blood.
No, missus, it isn't, said Tom, looking up, but he gives it to us, and that's the victory. When we can love and pray, over all and through all, the battle's past, and the victory's come, glory be to God.
And with streaming eyes and choking voice, the black man looked up to heaven.
All this, all Africa, latest call of nations, call to the crown of thorns, the scourge, the bloody sweat, the cross of agony, this is to be thy victory. By this shalt thou reign with Christ, when his kingdom shall come on earth.
The deep fervor of Tom's feelings, the softness of his voice, his tears, fell like dew on the wild, unsettled spirit of the poor woman. A softness gathered over the lurid fires of her eye. She looked down, and Tom could feel the relaxing muscles of her hands, as she said,
"Didn't I tell you that evil spirits followed me? Oh, Father Tom, I can't pray. I wish I could. I never have prayed since my children were sold. What you say must be right. I know it must. But when I try to pray, I can only hate and curse. I can't pray."
"Poor soul," said Tom compassionately, "Satan desires to have ye, and sift ye as wheat. I pray the Lord for ye, oh, Miss Cassie, turn to the dear Lord Jesus. He came to bind up the broken-hearted and comfort all that mourn."
Cassie stood silent, while large, heavy tears dropped from her downcast eyes.
"Missy Cassie," said Tom, in a hesitating tone, after surveying her in silence, "if you only could get away from here. If the thing was possible, I advised ye and Emmeline to do it. That is, if you could go without blood guiltiness, not otherwise."
"Would you try it with us, Father Tom?"
"No," said Tom. "Time was when I would, but the Lord's given me a work among these ye poor souls, and I'll stay with them and bear my cross with them till the end. It's different with you. It's a snare to you. It's more than you can stand, and you'd better go, if you can."
"I know no way but through the grave," said Cassie. "There's no beast or bird but can find a home somewhere. Even the snakes and the alligators have their place to lie down and be quiet, but there's no place for us. Down in the darkest swamps, their dogs will hunt us out and find us. Everybody and everything is against us. Even the very beasts side against us. And where shall we go?"
Tom stood silent. At length he said, "Him that saved Daniel in the den of lions, that saved the children in the fiery furnace, him that walked on the sea and bade the winds be still, he's alive yet, and I've faith to believe he can deliver you. Try it, and I'll pray with all my might for you." By what strange law of mind it is that an idea long overlooked and trodden underfoot as a useless stone suddenly sparkles out in new light, as a discovered diamond. Cassie had often revolved for hours all possible or probable schemes of escape, and dismissed them all as hopeless and impracticable. But at this moment there flashed through her mind a plan, so simple and feasible in all its details, as to awaken an instant hope.
"Father Tom, I'll try it," she said, suddenly.
"Amen," said Tom. "The Lord help ye."
Chapter 39. The Stratagem. The way of the wicked is as darkness. He knoweth not at what he stumbleth. Proverbs 4:19. The garret of the house that Legree occupied, like most other garrets, was a great desolate space, dusty, hung with cobwebs and littered with cast-off lumber. The opulent family that had inhabited the house in the days of its splendor had imported a great deal of splendid furniture, some of which they had taken away with them, while some remained standing desolate in mouldering, unoccupied rooms, or stored away in this place. One or two immense packing boxes in which this furniture was brought stood against the sides of the garret. There was a small window there which let in, through its dingy, dusty panes, a scanty, uncertain light on the tall, high-backed chairs and dusty tables that had once seen better days. Altogether it was a weird and ghostly place, but ghostly as it was, it wanted not in legends among the superstitious negroes to increase its terrors. Some few years ago a negro woman, who had incurred Legree's displeasure, was confined there for several weeks. What passed there we do not say. The negroes used to whisper darkly to each other, but it was known that the body of the unfortunate creature was one day taken down from there and buried. And after that it was said that oaths and cursings and the sound of violent blows used to ring through the old garret and mingled with wailings and groans of despair. Once when Legree chanced to overhear something of this kind, he flew into a violent passion and swore that the next one that told stories about that garret should have an opportunity of knowing what was there, for he would chain them up there for a week. This hint was enough to repress talking, though, of course, it did not disturb the credit of the story in the least. Gradually the staircase that led to the garret and even the passageway to the staircase were avoided by everyone in the house, from everyone fearing to speak of it, and the legend was gradually falling into desuetude. It had suddenly occurred to Cassie to make use of the superstitious excitability which was so great in Legree, for the purpose of her liberation and that of her fellow sufferer. The sleeping room of Cassie was directly under the garret. One day, without consulting Legree, she suddenly took it upon her, with some considerable ostentation, to change all the furniture and appurtenances of the room to one at some considerable distance. The underservants who were called on to effect this movement were running and bustling about with great zeal and confusion when Legree returned from a ride. "Hallo, you Cass?" said Legree. "What's in the wind now?" "Nothing, only I chose to have another room," said Cassie doggedly. "And what for, pray?" said Legree. "I choose to," said Cassie. "The devil you do, and what for?" "I'd like to get some sleep now and then." "Sleep? Well, what hinders your sleeping?" "I could tell, I suppose, if you want to hear," said Cassie dryly. "Speak out, you minx," said Legree. "Oh, nothing. I suppose it wouldn't disturb you. Only groans and people scuffing and rolling around on the garret floor half the night from 12 to morning." "People up garret," said Legree, uneasily, but forcing a laugh. "Who are they, Cassie?" Cassie raised her sharp black eyes and looked in the face of Legree with an expression that went through his bones as she said, "To be sure, Simon, who are they? I'd like to have you tell me. You don't know, I suppose?" With an oath Legree struck at her with his riding whip, but she glided to one side and passed through the door, and looking back said, "If you'll sleep in that room, you'll know all about it. Perhaps you'd better try it." And then immediately she shut and locked the door. Legree blustered and swore and threatened to break down the door, but apparently thought better of it, and walked uneasily into the sitting-room. Cassie perceived that her shaft had struck home, and from that hour, with the most exquisite address, she never ceased to continue the train of influences she had begun. In a knot-hole of the garret that had opened, she had inserted the neck of an old bottle in such a manner that when there was the least wind, most doleful and lugubrious wailing sounds proceeded from it, which in a high wind increased to a perfect shriek, such as to credulous and superstitious ears might easily seem to be that of horror and despair. These sounds were from time to time heard by the servants, and revived in full force the memory of the old ghost legend. A superstitious creeping horror seemed to fill the house, and though no one dared to breathe it to Legree, he found himself encompassed by it, as by an atmosphere. No one is so thoroughly superstitious as the godless man. The Christian is composed by the belief of a wise, all-ruling Father, whose presence fills the void unknown with light and order. But to the man who has dethroned God, the spirit land is indeed, in the words of the Hebrew poet, a land of darkness and the shadow of death, without any order, where the light is as darkness. Life and death to him are haunted grounds, filled with goblin forms of vague and shadowy dread. Legree had had the slumbering moral elements in him roused by his encounters with Tom, roused only to be resisted by the determinate force of evil, but still there was a thrill and commotion of the dark in a world produced by every word or prayer or hymn that reacted in superstitious dread. The influence of Cassie over him was of a strange and singular kind. He was her owner, her tyrant and tormentor. She was, as he knew, wholly and without any possibility of help or redress in his hands. And yet so it is that the most brutal man cannot live in constant association with a strong female influence and not be greatly controlled by it.
When he first bought her, she was, as she said, a woman delicately bred, and then he crushed her, without scruple, beneath the foot of his brutality. But as time and debasing influences and despair hardened womanhood within her, and waked the fires of fiercer passions, she had become in a measure his mistress, and he alternately tyrannized over and dreaded her. This influence had become more harassing and decided, since partial insanity had given a strange, weird, unsettled cast to all her words and language. A night or two after this, Legree was sitting in the old sitting-room, by the side of a flickering wood fire, that threw uncertain glances round the room. It was a stormy, windy night, such as raises whole squadrons of nondescript noises in rickety old houses. Windows were rattling, shutters flapping, and wind carousing, rumbling and tumbling, down the chimney, and every once in a while puffing out smoke and ashes, as if a legion of spirits were coming after him. Legree had been casting up accounts and reading newspapers for some hours, while Cassie sat in the corner, sullenly looking into the fire. Legree laid down his paper, and seeing an old book lying on the table, which he had noticed Cassie reading, the first part of the evening took it up, and began to turn it over. It was one of those collections of stories of bloody murders, ghostly legends, and supernatural visitations, which, coarsely got up and illustrated, have a strange fascination for one who once begins to read them. Legree pooed and pished, but read, turning page after page. Till finally, after reading some way, he threw down the book with an oath. "You don't believe in ghosts, do you, Cass?" said he, taking the tongs and settling the fire. "I thought you'd more sense than to let noises scare you." "No matter what I believe," said Cassie sullenly. "Fellows used to try to frighten me with their yarns at sea," said Legree. "Never come it round me that way. I'm too tough for any such trash, tell ye." Cassie sat looking intensely at him in the shadow of the corner. There was that strange light in her eyes that always impressed Legree with uneasiness. "Them noises was nothing but rats in the wind," said Legree. "Rats will make a devil of a noise. I used to hear 'em sometimes down in the hold of the ship. And wind, Lord's sake, you can make anything out of wind." Cassie knew Legree was uneasy under her eyes, and therefore she made no answer, but sat fixing them on him with that strange, unearthly expression as before. "Come, speak out, woman, don't you think so?" said Legree. "Can rats walk downstairs and come walking through the entry, and open a door when you've locked it, and set a chair against it?" said Cassie. "And come walk, walk, walking right up to your bed and put out their hands so?" Cassie kept her glittering eyes fixed on Legree as she spoke, and he stared at her like a man in the nightmare, till when she finished by laying her hand, icy cold on his, he sprung back with an oath. "Woman, what you mean? Nobody did." "Oh, no, of course not. Did I say they did?" said Cassie, with a smile of chilling derision. "But did you—have you really seen? Come, Cass, what is it now? Speak out." "You may sleep there yourself," said Cassie, "if you want to know." "Did it come from the garret, Cassie?" "It? What?" said Cassie. "Why, what you told of?" "I didn't tell you anything," said Cassie, with dogged sullenness. Legree walked up and down the room uneasily. "I'll have this here thing examined. I'll look into it this very night. I'll take my pistols."
"Do," said Cassie. "Sleep in that room. I'd like to see you doing it. Fire your pistols. Do."
Legree stamped his foot and swore violently. "Don't swear," said Cassie. "Nobody knows who may be hearing you."
"Hark, what was that?"
"What?" said Legree, starting.
A heavy old Dutch clock that stood in the corner of the room began and slowly struck 12. For some reason or other, Legree neither spoke nor moved. A vague horror fell on him while Cassie, with a keen, sneering glitter in her eyes, stood looking at him, counting strokes.
12 o'clock, well now, we'll see," said she, turning and opening the door into the passageway and standing as if listening. "Hark, what's that?" said she, raising her finger. "It's only the wind," said Legree. "Don't you hear how cursedly it blows?"
"Simon, come here," said Cassie, in a whisper, laying her hand on his and leading him to the foot of the stairs. "Do you know what that is? Hark!"
A wild shriek came pealing down the stairway. It came from the garret. Legree's knees knocked together, his face grew white with fear. "Hadn't you better get your pistol?" said Cassie, with a sneer that froze Legree's blood. "It's time this thing was looked into, you know. I'd like to have you go up now. They're at it."
"I won't go," said Legree, with an oath.
"Why not? There ain't such thing as ghosts, you know. Come!" And Cassie flitted up the winding staircase, laughing and looking back after him. "Come on!"
"I believe you are the devil," said Legree. "Come back, you hag. Come back, Cass. You shan't go."
But Cassie laughed wildly and fled on. He heard her open the entry doors that led to the garret. A wild gust of wind swept down, extinguishing the candle he held in his hand.
and with it the fearful, unearthly screams, they seemed to be shrieked in his very ear. Legree fled frantically into the parlour with her. In a few moments he was followed by Cassie, pale, calm, cold as an avenging spirit, and with that same fearful light in her eye. "I hope you are satisfied," said she. "Blast you, Cass," said Legree. "What for?" said Cassie. "I only went up and shut the doors. What's the matter with that garret? Simon, do you suppose?" said she. "None of your business," said Legree. "Oh, it ain't. Well," said Cassie. "At any rate, I'm glad I don't sleep under it." Anticipating the rising of the wind that very evening, Cassie had been up and opened the garret window. Of course, the moment the doors were opened, the wind had drafted down and extinguished the light. This may serve as a specimen of the game that Cassie played with Legree, until he would sooner have put his head into a lion's mouth than to have explored that garret. Meanwhile, in the night, when everybody else was asleep, Cassie slowly and carefully accumulated there a stock of provisions sufficient to afford subsistence for some time. She transferred article by article a greater part of her own and Emmeline's wardrobe. All things being arranged, they only waited a fitting opportunity to put their plan into execution. By cajoling Legree and taking advantage of a good natural interval, Cassidy had got him to take her with him to the neighboring town, which was situated directly on the Red River. With a memory sharpened to almost preternatural clearness, she remarked every turn in the road and formed a mental estimate of the time to be occupied in traversing it. At the time, when all was matured for action, our readers may perhaps like to look behind the scenes and see the final coup d'etat. It was now near evening. Legree had been absent on a ride to a neighboring farm. For many days, Cassie had been unusually accommodating and gracious in her humors, and Legree and she had been, apparently, on the best of terms. At present, we may behold her and Emmeline in the room of the latter, busy in sorting and arranging two small bundles. "There, these will be large enough," said Cassie. "Now put on your bonnet, and let's start. It's just about the right time." "Why, they can see us yet," said Emmeline. "I mean they shall," said Cassie coolly. "Don't you know that they must have their chase after us, at any rate? The way of the thing is to be just this. We will steal out of the back door and run down by the quarters. Sambo or Quimbo will be sure to see us. They will give the chase, and we will get into the swamp. Then they can't follow us any further, till they go up and give the alarm, and turn out the dogs, and so on. And while they are blundering around and tumbling over each other, as they always do, you and I will slip along to the creek that runs back of the house and wade along in it till we get opposite the back door. That will put the dogs all at fault, for scent won't lie in the water. Everyone will run out of the house to look after us, and then we'll whip in at the back door and up into the garret, where I've got a nice bed made up in one of the great boxes. We must stay in that garret a good while, for I tell you he will raise heaven and earth after us. He'll muster some of those old overseers on the other plantations, and have a great hunt, and they'll go over every inch of the ground in that swamp. He makes it his boast that nobody ever got away from him, so let him hunt at his leisure." "Cassie, how well you have planned it," said Emmeline. "Whoever would have thought of it but you?" There was neither pleasure nor exultation in Cassie's eyes, only a despairing firmness. "Come," she said, reaching her hand to Emmeline. The two fugitives glided noiselessly from the house and flitted through the gathering shadows of evening, along by the quarters. The crescent moon set like a silver signet in the western sky, delayed a little the approach of night. As Cassie expected, when quite near the verge of the swamps that encircled the plantation, they heard a voice calling to them to stop. It was not Sambo, however, but Legree, who was pursuing them with violent execrations. At the sound, the feebler spirit of Emmeline gave way, and laying hold of Cassie's arm, she said, "Oh, Cassie, I'm going to faint." "If you do, I'll kill you," said Cassie, drawing a small glittering stiletto and flashing it before the eyes of the girl. The diversion accomplished the purpose. Emmeline did not faint and succeeded in plunging with Cassie into a part of the labyrinth of swamp so deep and dark that it was perfectly hopeless for Legree to think of following them without assistance. "Well," said he, chuckling brutally, "at any rate, they've got themselves into a trap now, the baggage! They're safe enough, they shall sweat for it." "Aloha there, Sambo, Quimbo! All hands!" called Legree, coming to the quarters, when the men and women were just returning from work. "There's two runaways in the swamps. I'll give $5 to any niggers catches 'em. Turn out the dogs, turn out Tiger and Fury and the rest." The sensation produced by this news was immediate. Many of the men sprang forward officiously to offer their services, either from the hope of the reward or from that cringing subserviency which is one of the most baleful effects of slavery. Some ran one way and some another. Some were getting flambeaux of pine knots. Some were uncoupling the dogs, whose hoarse savage bay added not a little to the animation of the scene. "Massa, shall we shoot him if can't catch him?" said Sambo, to whom his master brought out a rifle. "You may fire on Cass, if you like. It's time she was gone to the devil, where she belongs. But the gal not," said Legree. "And now, boys, be spry and smart. $5 for him that gets him,
and a glass of spirits to every one of you anyhow. The whole band, with the glare of blazing torches and whoop and shout and savage yell of man and beast, proceeded down to the swamp, followed at some distance by every servant in the house. The establishment was, of a consequence, wholly deserted when Cassie and Emmeline glided into it the back way. The whooping and shouts of their pursuers were still filling the air, and looking from the sitting-room windows, Cassie and Emmeline could see the troop, with their flambeaux just dispersing themselves along the edge of the swamp.
"See there," said Emmeline, pointing to Cassie. "The hunt has begun. Look how those lights dance about. Hark, the dogs, don't you hear? If we were only there, our chances wouldn't be worth a picayune. Oh, for pity's sake. Do let's hide ourselves quick."
"There's no occasion for hurry," said Cassie coolly. "They are all out after the hunt. That's the amusement of the evening. We'll go upstairs by and by. Meanwhile," said she, deliberately taking a key from the pocket of a coat that Legree had thrown down in his hurry, "meanwhile, I shall take something to pay our passage." She unlocked the desk, took from it a roll of bills, which she counted over rapidly.
"Oh, don't let's do that," said Emmeline.
"Don't," said Cassie. "Why not? Would you have us starve in the swamps? Or have that, that will pay our way to the Free States? Money will do anything, girl." And as she spoke, she put the money in her bosom.
"Would be stealing," said Emmeline, in a distressed whisper.
"Stealing," said Cassie, with a scornful laugh. "They who steal body and soul needn't talk to us. Every one of these bills is stolen, stolen from poor, starving, sweating creatures who must go to the devil at last for his profit. Let him talk about stealing. But come, we may as well go up garret. I've got a stock of candles there, and some books to pass away the time. You may be pretty sure they won't come there to inquire after us. If they do, I'll play ghost for them." When Emmeline reached the garret, she found an immense box, in which some heavy pieces of furniture had once been brought, turned on its side so that the opening faced the wall, or rather the eaves. Cassie lit a small lamp, and creeping round under the eaves, they established themselves in it. It was spread with a couple of small mattresses and some pillows. A box nearby was plentifully stored with candles, provisions, and all the clothing necessary to their journey, which Cassie had arranged into bundles of an astonishingly small compass. "There," said Cassie, as she fixed the lamp into a small hook, which she had driven into the side of the box for that purpose. "This is to be our home for the present. How do you like it?"
"Are you sure they won't come and search the garret?"
"I'd like to see Simon Legree doing that," said Cassie. "No, indeed. He will be too glad to keep away. As to the servants, they would any of them stand and be shot sooner than show their faces here." Somewhat reassured, Emmeline settled herself back on her pillow.
"What did you mean, Cassie, by saying you would kill me?" she said simply.
"I meant to stop your fainting," said Cassie. "And I did do it. And now I tell you, Emmeline, you must take up your mind not to faint. Let what will come. There's no sort of need of it. If I had not stopped you, that wretch might have had his hands on you now." Emmeline shuddered. The two remained some time in silence. Cassie busied herself with a French book. Emmeline, overcome with the exhaustion, fell into a doze and slept some time. She was awakened by loud shouts and outcries, the tramp of horses' feet, and the baying of dogs. She started up with a faint shriek. "Only the hunt coming back," said Cassie coolly. "Never fear. Look out of this knot-hole. Don't you see him all down there? Simon has to give up for this night. Look how muddy his horse is, flouncing about in the swamp. The dogs, too, look rather crestfallen. Ah, my good sir, you'll have to try the race again and again. The game isn't there."
"Oh, don't speak a word," said Emmeline. "What if they should hear you?"
"If they do hear anything, it will make them very particular to keep away," said Cassie. "No danger. We may make any noise we please, and it will only add to the effect." At length the stillness of midnight settled down over the house. Legree, cursing his ill luck and vowing dire vengeance on the morrow, went to bed.
Chapter 40. The Martyr. Deem not the just by heaven forgot, though life its common gifts deny, though with a crushed and bleeding heart, and spurned of man, he goes to die. For God hath marked each sorrowing day, and numbered every bitter tear, and heaven's long years of bliss shall pay, for all his children suffer here. Bryant. The longest way must have its close. The gloomiest night will wear on to a morning. An eternal, inexorable lapse of moments is ever hurrying the day of the evil to an eternal light, and the night of the just to an eternal day. We have walked with our humble friend thus